Again, the address is 419 Lovett Boulevard, Houston, Texas, 77006. You are listening to KPFT Houston.
Here on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. This will be a call-in show, but we have a pre-recorded interview first, so we'll start taking phone calls roughly at half past the hour. The phone number, if you want to wait in line and be among the first, is 713-526-5738. The topic tonight is the coming 100-year Starship Symposium, which is going to be held at the George R. Brown Convention Center next week, September 18th to 21st. It's going to be something rather special. Essentially, the essence of the project is to see what kinds of incremental advances would be necessary in areas like science and environment and laundry and just all kinds of sociology, many, many different areas of study, many different disciplines, looking at things that would perhaps be necessary for a 100-year Starship mission, or I'm sorry, a Starship mission in 100 years, but that can also be used on Earth and can also be used in our current space programs. Really, really interesting concept. So I have two guests. One I interviewed yesterday afternoon, and her name is Dr. Mae Jemison. She is an ex-NASA astronaut. She is the first, and I misspoke this in the recording, so I'll do it here. She is the first African-American woman to go into space. She has worked in the Peace Corps as a medical officer, and she is one of the founders and leader of the 100-year Starship project. The other guest, who will be live and will be able to respond to questions and comments after the half hour, is Dr. Carl Aspelund, a Ph.D. in anthropology and materials culture, and he teaches at the University of Rhode Island, and he will call in live, and you'll be able to interact with him. So I'm going to give you the phone number one more time, and then we're going to start the interview, 713-526-5738. You can call in and hold for the second half hour if you would like, or you can call in a little bit later. And now, if Egberto is ready with the recording, we're going to go to my interview that I did yesterday afternoon with Dr. Mae Jemison.
My guest tonight is Dr. Mae Jemison. She's a former astronaut, first American woman in space in NASA, former Peace Corps medical officer, and the leader of the 100-year Starship project. How are you doing tonight, Dr. Mae?
I'm doing fine. Just 100-year Starship.
Yes.
We're having a public symposium here in Houston next week, the 18th through the 21st, and I would like to be on record inviting all Houstonians to attend, anybody who's interested in how do we shape the future, to be a part of it.
You know, one of the things I noticed is this seems a little bigger, a little more ambitious than last year. Last year, it was limited kind of to the Hilton.
Well, you know, this year,
now it's grown into the George R. Brown Convention Center, and it also seems like it's planned to be a lot more friendly to people who are maybe not science geeks.
Well, let me tell you that our whole time, we've always been interested in having the public at large involved. 100 Year Starship is a project that we won a competitive grant from DARPA to make sure that all the capabilities needed to send humans to another star system exist within the next 100 years. And notice I use the word capabilities. And I'll tell you again what our proposal was entitled, the proposal it won. It was called An Inclusive, Audacious Journey Transforms Life Here on Earth and Beyond. And again, the first word is inclusive, because the only way we can do really great things as a society, as a species, is if we get everybody involved, or get as many people involved across ethnicity, gender, geography, but also across disciplines. So our whole idea with the public symposium, which it's always been, is to have lots of people involved. And have the public involved. I think perhaps it feels more welcoming because we're at the George R. Brown versus, you know, at a hotel at the Hyatt.
Yeah.
But we want people to come. So we have events going on ranging from an expo called Expo Inspire that's for students and young folks. It's free on Saturday. They get to hands-on work, and also get to work with, yes, rocket scientists, things like that. We have a college Alka Rockets Challenge that students can go on and be involved in. College students who submit designs get free admission to the entire symposium, as well as events like Sci-Fi Night. So that may actually seem more welcoming. Well, Sci-Fi Night is really about the fact that depending on how well you tell the story, people want to be involved. We're actually going to have award-winning science fiction authors talking about their stories about Interstellar, including some who are actually, rocket scientists from Marshall Space Flight Center, Les Johnson, people who push on cultural issues like Niecy Shaw. And then we're going to show The Day the Earth Stood Still, the original, 1955 Day the Earth Stood Still.
Bernard Herrmann, great score.
Well, and the reason why is because that sort of got us all involved with the kinds of things that we think about if we think about our plight as humans right here on this planet, those things we need to do going forward, especially at the time period we are in the world right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's also about that hopefulness, the things that we can do better. And it'll be critiqued by the authors as well as people on the 100-Year Starship team like Dr. Rocky Olabisi, who is a biomedical engineering professor, a young woman who's a biomedical engineering professor at Rutgers. And I bring that up is because we want to understand that everybody is getting to cross a range of things. We'll have programs like Makers, Women in Space. Makers is a PBS platform that looks at chronicling the contributions of women in the United States in the modern day. One of the things that we often don't think about when we think about the future and who's developing the technologies and things are women. And the Makers Women in Space documentary that will be pre-screening will be followed by a panel discussion with women who've been involved in space exploration, me, Peggy Whitson, who is the head of the astronaut program now as an astronaut, the first woman commander of the space station, Nichelle Nichols, who helped to recruit the first women astronauts, who people often don't think of. Nichelle Nichols, her character in Lieutenant Uhura in Star Trek was really pivotal for so many people. So we're really pushing out on helping people to understand the things that go on. We have lots of different aspects of projects that we're thinking of. We even have steampunk. You know what steampunk is?
I actually do. I've actually explained that once or twice for my audience. It's basically the 19th century where they only had steam power, but steam power with a much higher level of technology than they ever achieved.
So it was this whole imagining about, what do you do if you need to create new technologies or if we want to create more sophisticated technologies, but we don't want to use silicon and go digital, right?
Yeah.
And that's really interesting from a perspective of doing something really imaginative and going someplace that you don't know anything about, like space or other planets, because the manufacture making these things are much more difficult. So let's take a look at it from the point of view as if you had to create those kinds of things that you see. Are those kinds of technologies, those kinds of automations that we know now that rely on, I'm going to call it silicon or digital kinds of technology, but let's make it out of things that are mechanical. And it's an exercise that we like to have people involved in. If folks want to think about steampunk, think of, what is it, the Game of Shadows with the Sherlock Holmes movie, right? That's steampunk. That's the kind of thing where you're doing things that you don't know you can do. Our League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, right?
I do want to mention one thing that we haven't touched on yet, which is you can get information about this online. I want to make sure, because people come and go during the radio show, and I want to make sure people know you can go to my website, thinkwingradio.com, and I have a number of links associated with the symposium. You can also go directly to 100YSS.org. That's 100YSS for 100-year starship.org. And there's a great deal of information there about this, and I will touch on this again later in the show. One of the things that I think is great, I have spoken in the past that I think one of the reasons that our civilization, our American civilization, seems to be getting less literate in terms of history and science and technology is museums have gotten to be a very expensive trip out for a family of four. You can spend $100 going to a museum with a father, a mother, and a couple of kids. And, you know, when you have a choice between spending $100 at the Museum of Natural Science and $100 at an Astros game, for many families, the choice becomes really simple. So I have advocated that I think that museums should be free or nearly free to encourage people to this kind of fun, painless learning. And that's what I particularly like about the notion of Expo Inspire, that this is an affordable day out for a whole family. When you talk about no charge for children under 18 and no charge for students and only $5 for adults. I mean, literally, possibly even without parking if you take mass transit or if you're in walking distance. And you could literally go out and take a family of four or five or six and maybe only spend $20, $30 for the whole family. And I think that that's a really, really important contribution to this whole enterprise.
Well, we wanted to make sure that people have an opportunity to participate and see what this is about. I think one of the things that is very clear is that where the world goes depends on who gets involved. And what I mean by that, you know, technologies don't just hang out there waiting for somebody to discover.
There has to be a driver. There has to be a driver to develop
technology.
There
has to be a driver. There has to be something that says, here's what we want to do with this knowledge. For example, the same combination of minerals that propels a bullet is what makes a beautiful fireworks display. That decision to use that technology one way or the other is dependent upon the people.
And I think it's important to mention that when we talk about the 100-year starship, it's very easy for people, especially people who are not so supportive of space exploration, to go, who's going to care about what happens in 100 years? Why should I worry about all this technology that's going to be my grandchildren's concern and it's a waste of money anyhow? And an important point here is all of this technology is developed incrementally. It's not something that's not going to be used and not going to be used and all of a sudden in a century we'll have an application for it. This is incrementally used for things like the Orion space capsule, the International Space Station, unmanned or manned missions to Mars or other planets.
Missions with people on it or not, because we could send up women and it would be unmanned, right?
Unpersoned.
So let's make it clear. But let me give you a better example in terms of not only going out in space, but what do we do with it now? Everybody pick up your smartphone, right? Turn it on. Put on that Maps application, right, and say, you know, give me directions to wherever. You're holding space in your hand.
Yeah,
people. By global positioning satellites. So this is not something that's outside of any of us. In Houston, we care about what's going on with weather and the remote sensing. But then you could get into the materials or that magnetic resonance imaging, the MRI mm-hmm. image that you get when you go to the hospital, and it's, you know, all about your health and it's very personal to you. It uses the same kinds of computer software that was developed to help us get images of Venus. That same, because when you try to get an image of Venus remotely, you look down, you get all these electronic signals, and you have to make it into a picture. The same thing happens when you put your body in this huge magnet. You have to make a picture out of it, and those same algorithms that were derived from space-based technologies. So we don't have to go out into the future. We don't have to stay in space, but it's something that makes a difference to all of us right now. And secondly, I would tell people that they should care about what happens with their grandchildren. Right now, when we talk about what are the really cool things we talk about these days? Genetic engineering, right? Personalized medicine, that we can do DNA sequencing, right? So we understand what's going on with our genomes. That's really cool. Laser technology is really cool, right? We use lasers for everything from measurements. Now we have them with our carpenters, right? Are using laser measurements to getting your eyes, you know, getting our cataracts removed or things done with our eyes. All of those things are with lasers.
I think
laser technology was developed in, it was first started to be thought about in the late 1950s. DNA was sequenced. We started learning how to sequence DNA and stuff in the late 50s, the early 60s. That's when we started doing that. But it's yet today that these things are having this profound effect on our economy.
You know, we talk about incrementalism, that the point of the 100-year starship project isn't to wait 100 years until all the technologies are mature. It's to advance in these things in ways that are useful at our current time, contemporaneously. And when you look at the advances that have taken place over the last 50, 60 years in my lifetime, they're so incremental that as they happen, you go, oh, wow, that's cool. And then in 5 years, you forget that this is something exceptional. But, you know, hurricane prediction. We used to have to do it with airplanes before we could do it at all. Or we had to do it with ships who would do semaphores. And I mean, now we have satellites that can track the path of these things and remotely measure the speeds. It's unbelievable. When people watch the Olympics, they don't remember that there was a time you had to wait a week to get that film. And now it happens. It can happen live if NBC chooses to do so.
Exactly. And these are the things where, you know, I want folks to come in and be a part of determining what happens. But there's something that I think is really important about how we look at 100-year starship and the whole idea of developing these technologies, these capabilities. We have to remember that governance is a capability as well. How people interact with one another is a capability as well. And so we're very interested in developing a kind of global aspiration about being able to use our ambition and our drive and our adrenaline for something that's going to end up being positive.
Well, you know, it's worth noting in that vein that GPS was originally developed for the military. It was a top secret capability. And then under Clinton, he decided to declassify it and permit civilian use. And, of course, that created a whole industry. But my being able to get to this station the first time when I wasn't sure how to get here, that was originally a military capability.
But and I would add, though, that some of those things came from, they may have started off and been developed in the military, but a lot of them came from ideas of people who were involved in different areas, right? So it's who gets the scholarships? We want, what you'll find with 100-year starship is we talk about inclusion. So it is my job to make sure that when people look up on the stage, they get to see the wide variety of people who are involved with design, policy, other issues. Space has policies associated with it in law, right? Who owns the moon?
Yeah.
It's going to get, when we get there and we decide to lay out stuff, who actually owns it? If we only send commercial enterprises, do they get to own it? The first person who lands there with an X Prize something?
Well, there are treaties about, you know, that no nation can claim the moon. But of course, historically, possession is 9/10 of the law. You know, you look at South America, and originally Portugal was only supposed to get a little tip because they didn't know where the land was. And when they realized that little tip was all there was, and then there was ocean, they encroached on that treaty area that the Pope had actually given to Spain. So we can have all the treaties that say that no nation can claim the moon, but if there is one nation that has the capability and decides to make a claim, they can enforce it.
Or if it's not even a nation, what about if it's a company?
Worse still.
So these are the things that are really important for us to think about. You know, we will actually have sessions talking about treaties. We'll actually have some golly gee wild technologies, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we'll have a session where Dr. Peter Swan is talking about a space elevator. So this is a new launch system that's very different from getting from the ground to orbit, where you literally create an elevator that goes 100,000 kilometers above the Earth. It's not easy to do, but it's technically feasible right now. So this gets rid of that having to, you know, launch the large rockets and things like that.
Not to mention the pollution from the fuel.
Technology for doing it. So we have those kinds of things where people can sit down and get their geek on, right? You can get your geek on in terms of education. We have a whole session that talks about groups of people who are interested in education. There are whole groups of people who are interested in design. In fact, I believe you'll be talking with Dr. Carl Espelon, who is a professor of textile and design at the University of Rhode Island, you know, sort of really pushing on these things that are part of our everyday lives, but actually have to have people think about them.
Is there anything that has cropped up in the last couple of years that has been inspired by this project that has become, I don't want to say operational or functional, but looks, perhaps it has, but looks like it may have promise for everyday life or for current space technology or technology generally?
So I'm going to tell you, we are 2.5 years old,
mm-hmm.
right? So what we're actually doing right now is creating our organization and pushing forward. Some of the ideas that we're working on are not just to do the research, but get more people involved. I'm actually hope that what we're doing is getting more people to think about bolder science, bolder human exploration, bolder human assertion as to what we can be. And before anybody gets upset and thinks that I'm saying science exists in a vacuum or technology exists by itself, let me say again, what we do with our knowledge depends on the people who are involved. It depends on their mindset, their ethics. And so that's the reason why we need lots of people involved, is so that we can have a better cut at this. Some of the things, you know, I hope we're looking at ideas around remote sensing. We're helping to design a center for advanced aerospace manufacturing at a community college. Yes, community college, because despite all that really incredible stuff that, you know, people show pictures of astronauts and PhDs and things like that, we wouldn't go anywhere if we didn't have the skilled labor that's able to build and construct and manufacture these things. So our contributions right now, and we know that they will grow, is about helping to change the tone about who does space and what kind of things it can contribute. In the future, we're looking at, you know, technology, ideas around sustainability. Just think about it.
Better way to do laundry.
Better way to do laundry.
Which I know they talked about last year.
Better way to do laundry. Why? Because taking care of clothes and manufacturing clothes is a very resource-intense process. And if we can figure out how to recycle it, to do it better in a closed environment like a Starship would have to be, imagine how that would improve its impact, laundry and clothing's impact on this world. I was going to go to agriculture, right?
Yeah.
Growing food. If we start to understand a lot more about things like the microbiome, that's the buzzword today, right? The
right.
microbiome, those are all the little microbes that are in the soil, that are in our gut, right, that help us to absorb nutrients. We need to know a lot about that, because as what science is finding, what medicine is finding, what agricultural scientists are finding, is as those microbes are disturbed, and if they're not healthy, then you don't get healthy crop growth and you don't have healthy bodies.
It's actually become on its own a whole area of research. They're beginning to realize just how critical even the mix of microbiological life in the gut and in plants and in other areas of the ecology really is. It's kind of remarkable.
And so we talk about that. We'll actually have a session this time considering all those things in medicine that could hold us back. So ranging from, do we have a biological emergency, right? If we want to think about that, do we have a biological emergency on this planet? How can the knowledge that we gain from, you know, looking at space and life and biology in space, how does that help us here?
I think one obvious possibility is when you talk about people trying to live in marginal environments here on Earth, the more we know about how you can maximize the use of resources or how you can enhance lifestyle with small inputs of resources the way you would need to on a space mission, that could actually improve the life of people that are struggling here on Earth.
It could help improve the life of people who are struggling, and it could help decrease the impact of the life of people who have so much and sort of squander it, right? So are there ways that we could more rationally use all the resources we have here? Right now, we produce things with very low efficiencies of energy input, our material input, even in places that have a lot. Wouldn't it make sense to figure out how they could produce these things with less?
The old refrain, let's do more with less.
Let's do more with less, but let's, you know, make sure that what we're using, we use effectively.
I think
as efficiently as possible. Those are some of the ways when you use this perspective of doing something as difficult as going to another star system, all right, leaving our own star system, when you use that perspective, all of a sudden it opens up so many things back here on Earth, how we can improve our lives here.
I think you have other things you need to do because I know you're at a conference on the West Coast right now. Do you want to let the listeners know how they can find out more information about the symposium and the events and what's free and what might cost a little money?
Absolutely. So people can go to 100yss.org, 100yss.org, to find information. Go to symposium. It's a 2014 symposium, and look for it. It's going to be at the George R. Brown Convention Center, September 18th through the 21st. There are a number of events that are freestanding. Expo Inspire takes place on Saturday the 20th. There'll also be a sci-fi night where you get to come in and get your popcorn and get to talk to sci-fi authors as well as see a movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still. If you buy it online beforehand, it's like $24. When have you ever gone to the movie for $24 and gotten popcorn?
Yeah, really.
And everything at the same
time.
The
popcorn can be $24.
Then there'll also be Maker's Night, and we're encouraging people to bring parent, child, which will happen on Saturday. So those are some of the major events, but I would suggest people come to the overall symposium, which is going to be fabulous, where you get to see a lot of these things that I've just talked about, as well as all the plenary sessions, and interact with experts, enthusiasts, advocates from all around the world, be they in design, education, governance, or just, you know, plain old Joe around the block who wanted to know more about this area.
Well, let's just invite people to see what may be possible and to learn about what is being done now. I thank you very much, Dr. Mae Jamieson. I'm really looking forward to going. Last year was a lot of fun, and I'm hoping this year we'll get a lot more people to see just how much fun and how interesting it is and what's possible.
And the last thing I want to add,
yes.
We're in Houston. We're centered in Houston.
That's correct. The George R. Brown Convention Center right here in town. So people from all over Southeast Texas can easily access the symposium.
That's right.
So we invite everyone. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it very much. I'll look forward to seeing the symposium and running into you while I'm there.
I look forward to it.
All right. You have a great day, and thanks so much for your time and interview.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And we're back live. That was my interview with Dr. Mae Jamison yesterday afternoon. We are live now. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM. And we can now take phone calls. 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. We're going to be talking about the 100-Year Starship Symposium. And my second guest tonight is live, so you can talk to him, Dr. Carl Aspelund, Ph.D. in Anthropology and Material Culture. He teaches at the University of Rhode Island. And how are you doing tonight, Dr. Carl?
Hey, I'm great, Mike. Nice to talk to you again.
Thank you. Same here. I actually was going to do a whole different line of questioning until Jenny Lawhorn wrote to me that you got involved with the 100-Year Starship Project almost literally by accident when you heard someone talking about it on the radio.
Oh, absolutely, yes. I had the classical driveway moment, the NPR driveway moment.
I actually, there's a great quote. I got it from somewhere when I was doing research on you for our first interview, where you say, I was sort of the odd man out there at first. There were astrophysicists, biologists, and system engineers, and then there's me with the dirty socks and laundry, because you're a textile guy.
That's right. I come from a costume and a fashion background, and I've been teaching at a textiles and fashion merchandising and design department now for almost 18 years, and have a long background in this. My doctorate in anthropology is only 3 or 4 years old, but even my research interests there are in clothing. But yeah, this first Starship conference 2 years ago, I came down by accident, as you say. I spoke to May in August. The conference was in September. And I had heard her speaking on the radio on a drive home. And then I literally sat in the driveway. I had to hear the end of this interview. I was so completely fascinated by everything she was saying, and I always am. But that first time, I was completely just gripped by this. And I went straight inside. It was early in the morning. I was coming home after a night at the hospital, actually. My daughter was very ill. And I wrote an email, and I said, sounds like a marvelous idea, the 100-Year Starship. Is anybody thinking about what people are going to be wearing? And, you know, it sort of seemed like just sort of an impulsive and an insane idea. But 2 days later, I'm on the phone with Alaris, and they're saying, come on down to Houston, talk to us.
Now, what I think is great about that story, May, during her recorded interview, was talking about inclusiveness, getting people involved who might not otherwise think of getting involved. And I think you're a great example of that. So I think what we want to do is mention to other people out there who may be listening to this show, maybe you're an artist, maybe you're a sociologist, maybe you deal in people's responses to colors and environment, maybe it's music, maybe whatever it is.
Who knows? Yeah.
If you think outside the box, what might be your possible contribution that you never thought anybody would care about, and yet you've thought to yourself, you know, in an isolated environment where you have a small number of people for an extended period of time, might this matter? Might this be something that would help? And you had that driveway moment, and maybe
Absolutely.
Someone out there.
If you're going to send a group of people into, as you say, an isolated environment, perhaps for a very long time, or even you know, the entirety of their lifespan, everything matters. It's not just the big stuff that matters. The small stuff matters.
Now, as a non-technician, as a non-scientist, have you ever had anything come into your mind as like, you know, gee, we're working with this. I wonder if anyone's ever thought about such and such. Do you ever have any ideas on something that's outside of your specialty that may not actually be like a science, but that you say, gee, you know, we really could use some ideas in this area that maybe you would shout out there, and maybe someone will suddenly have an aha moment?
Wow. Well, you know, Mike, that's I could go on for quite a while now, but you kind of summed it up just a moment ago by saying that it is practically everything. And you see, as an anthropologist, if I put my anthropologist hat on rather than my designer hat on, everything in human existence at some level of somebody's experience matters, right? Now, you can get people who are highly trained and very mission-focused and very oriented toward being on the space station or when the Apollo missions were going up to the moon. But in all of human experience, we have nothing that equals what the 100-year Starship program is proposing to do. We can only get close. We can only think of this in terms of, well, okay, we have had people in the ISS. We have had people up there. People have been in Antarctic bases. People have been in nuclear submarines. And we can sort of try to approach what it might be like to live in a small environment that's orbiting one of Jupiter's moons.
But at the end of the day, in a submarine, you can usually come up for air.
Eventually. Even during the height of the Cold War, when these crews would go down, perhaps anticipating that they might not ever come up again, the possibility is there. It's still there. But if you're on a small, ship, just off Titan somewhere, that's it.
You can't just open a window.
You can't just say, well, worst comes to worst, we'll surface, right?
Yeah.
And so things start to really matter. And if you just think of your day-to-day existence, and I've done a wonderful exercise with my students where I have asked them to pack the suitcase. I paint the picture for them. I tell them the scenario. Okay, you're going on the ship. Right, you're on the Starship, you're going out there, you're not coming back, it's a 40 to 50 year journey, because these are kids in their early 20s, and I say, we're going to give you the technology, we're going to give you the hygiene stuff, and your work clothes, so you get one personal bag, right? You get one standard suitcase. Now go.
It's kind of like the time machine, where at the end he takes three books, and they say, what three books would you have taken?
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly that exercise, except in this case, they start to really focus on each object. Because I don't even give them parameters. I just say, you have one suitcase, and you don't have to worry about work clothes. You don't have to worry about hygiene. You don't have to worry about technology. And the rest is up to you. You can, one student, because I did this with two classes that I was teaching, one here in Rhode Island, and another, that was fashion students, and then another class of ethnographers up in Iceland. And it was really amazing to see the different approaches. I mean, one of the ethnographers in Iceland, she filled her suitcase with knitting yarn and books.
Hmm.
And the fashion students, needless to say, were a little more focused on creature comforts and what they would need to wear and bring along.
What's cool in outer space?
What's cool in outer space? One of the students packed up, and because then what I asked them to do is I asked them to spread it all out and take a picture of it, and then they post and give me a list of what they put in the suitcase. And I noticed that one of the students had put a pair of 4-inch heels.
And, because nothing says space travel like stilettos.
Like stilettos. and so I asked her, I said, you are aware that this is a Starship we're talking about. And without hesitating, in a class, there were 60 students in the room. Without hesitating, she said, you can never be too sure.
Okay, I've got David on the line. Before I go to David, I just want to make one observation. In all the years that we've been in space, we've talked about the effects of zero gravity on bone and body fluids and muscles, and we are not going back to the moon in such a hurry, and yet we have no knowledge of what happens to astronauts in a persistent low-gravity environment. And that would seem to be one of the most important things we can learn, and there are apparently no plans except for very soon they're going to try something with mice, with centrifuge. But, I mean, in all these years, in a half a century, we still don't have any data on living in a low gravity versus micro or zero gravity environment. So I'm waiting for someone to do that. Okay, we're going to go to David. We do have open lines, 713-526-5738. We've lost Carl. We're hopefully going to get him back shortly. David, you're on the air. What's on your mind? And hopefully if you have a question for Carl, he'll be back shortly.
Oh, well, yeah, I had actually a couple of them. If I remember right, the ozone layer, of course, is this vast layer of pure oxygen, but it's a precise type of pure oxygen. It's three particles or three molecules bonded together.
I'm sorry, what? Start this over. I didn't catch the first part of what you said.
The ozone layer.
Oh, the ozone layer. Yeah,
yeah. And
O3.
It keeps the ultraviolet rays from cooking us.
Yes.
You know, if it wasn't for the ozone layer, we would be flash fried just like in a microwave.
Yes.
So the ozone layer is very important to survival for not only humans, for everything on the planet. And every time we punch through the ozone layer with a rocket ship, you know, if you set a match to oxygen, it's going to burst into flames.
Yeah, they had that problem once.
Yeah, and so the idea that we are launching rockets through the ozone layer and we're burning it up, so if there is going to be industry in outer space, in order to get things through the ozone layer, we're going to have to ruin our atmosphere. So that's the first thing, and I find it really preposterous that people are, you know, if you look at Virgin Airlines, they want to do this kind of like vacation jaunt up into outer space for
yes.
a few minutes and then come back down.
Right.
But they're basically talking about poisoning the ozone layer or ruining it just for a brief, you know, set of entertainment. And that's so it's so scary, you know, the vanity of destroying the Earth for that. But the other, and this gets into what you were talking about earlier in the show, if I remember right, there was a law of outer space that was developed just about the time the Soviet Union collapsed. There was a law of outer space that the nations of the world agreed that there would not be weapons in outer space. That we couldn't, you know, this was a big deal. You know, Ronald Reagan was trying to make the Star Wars thing.
Yes.
And so we came up with this treaty that said that we were not going to develop weapons for outer space. But every time they use a drone, they're using GPS satellites, and they're also using controllers are using those satellites as well to basically abuse the satellite system. So I just wonder if he could talk about both of those.
Well, we do have Carl back. Carl, I don't know if any of that falls into any of your areas of expertise or speculation.
Well, it does and it doesn't, in the sense that one of the things that I'm that I've been looking at, among other things, because I'm primarily focusing, though, on the sort of creature comforts and habitats, but you can't do that without thinking about human culture. And one of the things that I caught there, and I'm sorry, I missed the beginning of David's question or David's comments.
About the ozone layer?
But I did get the ozone layer part, so maybe I didn't miss as much as I thought.
No, you didn't.
But,
actually.
One of the things that does that does strike me, and there is for one thing the militarization of all this is a very worrying aspect. And May earlier in that recorded interview spoke of the the possibility that the commercialization of not just space travel but of resource gathering and mining might lead to some unfortunate results, to put it mildly. The idea that we can start harvesting or gathering resources in space without conflict developing, I think, is hugely optimistic. And I would worry not just about national militaries. I would worry about private militaries developing. Because once you have a franchise on asteroid mining, you're going to want to protect your interests.
Yeah, just like anywhere else, there's easy-to-access resources and hard-to-access resources,
so,
and everybody's going to want the easy. and you might go from warlords to space lords.
Yes. And one of the things, for example, that's really interesting to think about is that we have to be very careful about this, and this is actually something that I'm going to be leading a brainstorming seminar on at the conference next week, is that we have to be very careful about how we envisage the future when we are imagining ourselves into the future. And one of the unfortunate things that we do is that we neglect to just sort of look at the reality of the situation, that we imagine, for example, that for some reason, once we're in space, that this kind of conflict gets left behind on Earth.
Yeah, highly improbable.
I find that very improbable.
Putting maturity into outer space is a big deal, yeah.
Yeah,
and the idea that Eastern Mars won't be, in contact with Western Mars.
Martian block.
The Eastern Martian block. But you see where I'm going here. But
sure.
I realize I'm departing a little bit from David's comments.
Well,
obviously the ozone layer damage is worrying. I mean, the chlorine gas is a problem.
Does hydrazine incorporate chlorine? Because I know that hydrazine is a fuel that's often used. They're trying to get away from that now and go back to liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen, and even kerosene. Mm-hmm. Does hydrazine include chlorine or any other chemicals that the byproducts are dangerous to the ozone layer?
Well, the only thing I know is that the chlorine is a problem.
Right.
I honestly don't know what the actual chemistry is.
I know that ozone, or O3 as it's also called, is an unstable molecule, and it's constantly being created and destroyed. Mm-hmm. So the real issue is whether it builds back up or whether we are destroying it at a rate faster than it can reproduce, kind of like buffalo and passenger pigeons.
Well, there was actually rather good news, wasn't there, about the ozone layer just this week.
Hear that. I think I've heard it's increasing, though, since we stopped using...
Yeah, a couple percent. 4 or 6%. I can't remember the exact figures. So.
Yeah, it's been improving since the freon rules were changed, and the chlorine-free refrigerants have been used.
But the thing is, then again, and here's another point that we're going to make in that brainstorming session, is that any sort of large-scale social action, any time you try to influence the direction that society is going to go into, and deciding to go into space large scale is certainly an action like that. There are always unintended consequences.
Yes, the law of unintended consequences. Absolutely. You are listening to ThinkWing Radio with Mike Honig. I haven't mentioned earlier, my engineer is Egberto Willis. He does a Monday show called Politics Done Right. This is 90.1 FM in Houston. And we do have open lines, 713-526-5738.
Oh, by the way,
yes.
I have to think about the space junk problem.
Yeah.
And if I remember right, one of the reasons why the Treaty of Outer Space and the non-weaponization of outer space became an agreed-upon project was the idea of too much space junk. So say, for example, you've got either a mining operation up there or something explodes, the particles that are flying around are going to be either falling to Earth and God knows where it's going to land.
Australia and the Indian Ocean seem popular.
but in other words, nobody is exempt from the possibility that it could fall from the sky on anywhere. Much less that if you've got some expensive satellite floating around up there, the idea that all of the math has been put together for years and years and years, calculating where this space junk is and keeping up with its trajectories, but then all of a sudden something explodes with a war, with some weaponization, then all of a sudden everybody's investment in outer space can be subject to some boneheaded vanity.
Well, actually, the Chinese a few years ago did an anti-satellite experiment where they used an impactor to see if they could hit a dead satellite. And I think the U.S. military has also done a similar thing. And there were just all kinds of cries of outrage for all the debris that this spread.
Right.
I'm going to have to let you go, David. I appreciate your call. I thank you so much. My guest is Dr. Carl Aspelund. We're talking about the 100-year Starship Symposium. You can get information by going to 100yss.org. We have open lines, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT, and we have Jim on the line. Jim, how are you doing tonight? What's on your mind?
Pretty good. And you? Unusual subject.
Well, I am nothing if not eclectic.
It's great, though. I know. It's great. I hardly hear anybody talking about it. I just want to try to be real quick here.
Sure.
I don't think, you know, the ozone thing, rockets going through, I think the numbers of rockets going, you know, going through the atmosphere, I don't think, you know, that's going to be a big
jet aircraft,
you
know, are a bigger problem.
Yeah, I mean, the airlines are a much bigger impact on the ozone than the, you know, the few rockets going through. But it does touch on one interesting problem, which is, you know, the radiation. I mean, you know, up there you don't have the Earth's magnetic field to protect. You know, it's not just the ozone that protects us. The ozone protects us, I think, from ultraviolet rays, but there's also the Earth's magnetic field. Which intercepts all the charged particles,
and,
you know, like from the sun.
Didn't I hear recently that airline personnel, I don't know if they had a higher level of cancer or some other serious illness, they had a higher fraction of occurrence because presumably they're at 40,000 feet. And
yeah, I mean, you may have, I didn't hear that, but I mean, that sounds entirely reasonable. You know, and the other thing too is that, and I, of course, I don't know how much of a problem this is going to be, but even in the Earth's solar system, you have the sun, you know, which, you know, has a sphere of influence out to what's called like the heliopause.
Yes.
And when you get out to the heliopause, which is like somewhere out, you know, past Pluto, but I think Voyager 1.
It's out past the Oort cloud.
Yeah, they've gone through. Well, so at that point, then you start getting cosmic rays that are coming from, I'm not sure where, you know, I can't say I know where they're coming, but
the cosmos,
but they're galactic sources, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So, you know, we figured out how to, you know, deal with all this, you know, these various types of radiation. I think it's going to be we don't even know that we can get to Mars without, you know, frying our astronauts yet.
Carl, do you have any knowledge of, anything that's being worked on or any,
Yes, I'm actually working on this. Partly, this is one of the concerns that we have in terms of designing both habitats and clothing for long duration space flight. Is that we're going to have to build into all the sort of day to day operations, your basic clothing, your basic habitation. Is all going to have to include some kind of radiation shielding. We're just not going to get away from that. And it's a really interesting thing. I mean, we've kind of gotten away from this in human society. The more we live in cities, the more we forget that nature is really just always out to kill you.
Yeah.
And the further you go into space, the more truth there is in that. Oh, and by the way, the higher incidence of cancer among air crew is an actual. They've actually done studies that show that.
What is it that they find a higher incidence of specifically? There was something specific.
Well, it's various cancers that they can, and they attribute these to the simple just cosmic radiation.
Yeah.
They are higher up there, and there's the cosmic radiation. Both in airline crews and people who inhabit polar regions.
But the good news is, due to the theory of relativity, they will be younger. So
yes.
You win some, you lose some.
But there we are. But anyway, yes, I mean, one of the things we're trying to think about right now, because I'm sort of on the, I'm on the cusp, really, of preparatory research on one hand, and starting to think of ways in which I can start to apply the research on the other. And one of the first places we're going to bear down is this problem of radiation shielding.
You say you're working on it in terms of environment and apparel. Is there anything you can talk about in terms of what some of the lines of exploration are?
Well, only in the way that everything is up for grabs. Like we were talking about a little earlier this evening, nothing is. Given once you're out there in space, because everything has to be recyclable, everything has to be somehow adaptable to that environment. So just take any item that you consider a basic need. That item now has to be adapted to a new environment.
One of the more interesting ideas that I've heard is to build spacecraft that use the water supply between an inner and outer hull so that the water can block much of the cosmic radiation.
Yep.
And then as you use the water and it becomes wastewater, you pump it back into a different part of the shell so it still, at the very least, continues giving you some radiation protection.
Yep.
All of these interesting different ways of employing things.
But then there are different ways also of thinking about it depending on whether you're on a starship or whether you're actually on the surface of say Mars or anywhere. Because each one of these places has a different characteristic, and so, and most of them are deadly in one way or another.
As you say, nature is always out to kill you.
Yeah, one of the things they found on Mars now is that the dust on Mars' surface is far more toxic than was previously thought.
Now, I heard that it might be more oxidative than was originally thought. Are you talking about toxic in a different way?
No, well, it's toxic in the way that it reacts very badly with any sort of carbon-based life form. You wouldn't want it anywhere on any membranes of your body.
Hmm. I appreciate your call, Jim. Thank you so much for touching base with us and contributing to the show. One of the things that I've been curious about, and I just throw this out because we're talking starship and space travel, and I don't know if you have any notion, but one of the theories to explain the fact that Mars's atmosphere is so thin is that over geologic time, molecules of the atmosphere have been knocked out by solar radiation. And one of the things that's puzzled me is somehow Venus doesn't have that problem. Venus does not have a magnetic field, nor does Mars. Venus does not have a significant moon, nor does Mars. And yet Venus, much closer to the source of solar radiation in this solar system, has an atmosphere that's like the equivalent of being, I don't know, 500 or 1,000 feet underwater. And Mars has an atmosphere that's got 1% of the density of Earth. And that's I found very perplexing. I don't know that it has anything to do with anything you're working on,
well,
but I thought I'd throw it out.
Only again, like I say, that there's this strange notion that humans can go anywhere, and maybe we can't. You know, maybe one of the things we have to realize is that the amount of sort of external protection that it's going to require for us to be in certain places if we're going to start traveling around the solar system.
Okay. Unfortunately, we are out of time. My pre-recorded guest was Dr. Mae Jemison of the 100-Year Starship Project. My current guest is Dr. Carl Aspelund of the 100-Year Starship Project. You can get more information by going to 100yss.org or going to my website, thinkwingradio.com, and looking at the blog post for this show where I will be posting a copy of this recording. Dr. Carl, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. I know it's late for you. You're on Eastern time.
That's quite all right. Thanks, Mike.
All right. You take care. And remember, as Dr. Carl said, be careful out there because nature is always trying to kill you.
There will be a KPFT benefit on Saturday, September 13th from 4 to 7 p.m. downtown at Beer Paredes, 500 Louisiana Street. $10 cover charge at the door benefiting KPFT includes Beer Paredes Pizza Buffet, music, dance, and perhaps even a wee nip of Tom Horan's own Irish whiskey. Proceeds help KPFT to continue to bring great programming to you. Again, KPFT benefit happening on Saturday, September 13th from 4 to 7 p.m. at Beer Paredes Downtown, 500 Louisiana Street, the Alley Theater parking garage. We hope to see you there. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston, kpft.org worldwide. Find us on Twitter at KPFT or KPFT Houston on Facebook.
The following program may contain language or imagery that may be...
Hi, this is Sonali Kolhatkar. The Pacifica Radio Archives is the oldest collection of public radio programming in the United States. Within its walls, you'll find a vast collection of voices like Malcolm X, Noam Chomsky, Langston Hughes, Alice Walker, Paul Robeson, Howard Zinn, Gore Vidal, June Jordan, James Baldwin, Jermaine Greer, and many, many others. Visit the new user-friendly website at www.pacificaradioarchives.org, where you can hear samples from our collection in our new Listening Salon section. And you can now order your favorite programs on CD and cassette. Once again, that's www.pacificaradioarchives.org. This is Sonali Kolhatkar for the Pacifica Radio Archives.